your sea winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston. Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea waves crashing. While I watch the cannons flashing, I clean my gun and dream of Galveston. I still see her standing by the water, standing there looking out to sea. And is she waiting there for me on the beach where we used to run? Galveston, oh Galveston, I am so afraid of dying before I dry the tears she's crying. Before I watch your seabirds flying in the sun at Galveston, at Galveston.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this program, we're listening to Rosemary Gibson talk about her book, Medicare Meltdown, How Wall Street and Washington Are Ruining Medicare and How to Fix It, in which she looks at the future of Medicare.
It's interesting that President Obama used to talk about overuse. In a speech he gave to Congress in his first term, he mentioned it, that we need to curtail overuse. But I don't hear President Obama talking about overuse anymore as a factor in reducing Medicare spending. So once again, it's going to be informed members of the public who will have to put it back on the agenda. Citizens will have to be the ones to correct the misallocation of resources because it will not self-correct. While preparing for this talk, I was thinking about what are some of the solutions. And I was in Princeton, New Jersey a couple of weeks ago walking along Nassau Street, and there was a bookstore, and there was a quote in that bookstore about how democracy, to fix our democracy, we need more democracy. We need more informed citizens who are aware of what's going on to serve as a countervailing influence, a check and balance in the system. I think the biggest challenge we face is that healthcare companies whose primary duty is to shareholders, they have to demonstrate increased revenue and profitability. They have to do that as a condition of their corporate statutes. And this drives price and volume up. And this reality is in direct conflict with our needs as families, as employers, as state and federal governments to do the exact opposite. Here's a quote from Charles Prince, the CEO of Citigroup in 2007, "We'll keep dancing until the music stops." That was a theme in the Battle Over Healthcare book. One of the renowned capitalists of our time, John Bogle, was the founder of Vanguard Mutual Funds. And he describes what he calls the pathological mutation that has gripped Wall Street in his book, The Battle for the Soul of Capitalism. He said, what's happening, if money can't be made honestly, then what's happening is we're cheating. And I believe we have a battle waging for the soul of healthcare. We have that same pathological mutation gripping it to the dismay of ethical physicians. And the fallout from the pressure, older adults on Medicare are harmed by preventable adverse events. The OIG reports that 79,200 Medicare beneficiaries in hospitals die of preventable harm. And that was a topic I brought out in the book, The Wall of Silence. So where do we go and what do we do? I proposed in Medicare Meltdown that we need to have a conversation about setting limits on healthcare spending and Medicare spending. Here's the how much of the average Social Security check is needed to pay today for Medicare Part B and Part D premiums and copays. In 2010, a person who earned an average wage throughout his or her life and retired in 2010 paid 27% of their Social Security check just for Medicare Part B and D premiums and copays. It's an enormous sum of money. When Medicare was started, it was only 6%. It was only Part B back then. But look where it's headed. When I'm old, look how much it's going to be. For those of you who are young residents, look how much you'll be paying from your Social Security check. And now there's a debate in Washington to reduce the cost of living adjustments in Social Security. So what do we do about that? There's a wonderful line from the great law of the Iroquois: in our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations. In healthcare, we have to consider the impact of our decisions for our generation and the next generation, because we don't have seven generations to wait. From the Medicare trustees report, if assets were exhausted, Medicare could pay health plans and providers only to the extent allowed by ongoing tax revenues. They've projected that Medicare funding for hospital care will run out in 2024. They'll be able to pay only 90%. So should we have some limits to healthcare spending? What do you think? Is it time? If you think about it, every system has limits. Every family has a budget. Every business has a budget. Every government has a budget. A country can't function without red lights. How did this all start? It happened because of how Medicare was designed almost 50 years ago. There's no limit on how much hospitals and other providers can bill Medicare. There's no market mechanism or regulatory structure to place limits. This was the chief design flaw of Medicare when it was enacted in 1965. It's called the open-ended entitlement. What do you think? Should we change it? Do we need to install some red lights? Just last week, Medicare officials have proposed an ambitious effort to limit hospital spending so it grows no faster than the overall economy. It would use Maryland's unique rate-setting system to keep hospital spending from growing at roughly half its recent rate of increase. In the state of Massachusetts, the state legislature and governor agreed to legislation that capped total health care spending, both private and public, so it would not grow faster than the overall economy. What do you think? Should we do that? And even in Congress and the White House, both President Obama and members of Congress, Paul Ryan, have proposed limiting average Medicare spending per beneficiary to GDP growth plus 0.5%. We don't hear much about that, but both of them have proposed limits because they know that trajectory that we're on. What do you think? Should we have limits to how much we spend? The health care reform law had proposed an independent advisory board. It would be set up with 15 members appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, and members would recommend ways to curb Medicare spending. It was based on the Base Realignment and Closure Commission. Remember, in the United States, we had to close a lot of military bases. It's very hard for elected officials to make those decisions to close a military base in their own constituency. So they ceded that responsibility to experts, and Congress had to agree or disagree. That was the model used for the Independent Payment Advisory Board. It cannot change Medicare eligibility, cannot ration care, raise premiums, cut benefits. And if Congress doesn't like any of the recommendations, it doesn't have to agree with any of them. But it would have to come up to find equivalent savings of its own. But what happened? It was repealed in the U.S. House of Representatives. Claims of rationing and government interference in the doctor-patient relationship were made. Is that what the opposition was really all about? Was it about the interests of patients? Or was it about the interest of not being able to see continued revenue growth? I propose in Medicare Meltdown that the real reason for the opposition was the healthcare industry's desire to remove any impediment to what they have to do as a condition of their doing business, which is to keep doing business. And also, the industry has tight relationships with members of Congress and didn't want to take that away and give it to non-elected officials. But again, remember, Congress still had the final say. So for the public watching this on C-SPAN, the main message here is that the public's entitlement to Medicare, in my view, is not what is causing Medicare to fall over the cliff. Yet the debate that we're having in Washington is putting the onus on older adults, raising the eligibility age, increasing premiums. The healthcare industry's sense of entitlement to Medicare's money, I believe, is what is driving Medicare over the cliff. And as you listen to the Medicare debates in the coming months and years, this is an issue that you might want to keep in mind, and you can decide for yourself what you think. For residents in this room, for the young physicians, what does the future look like? While this gives you the reality of the overall context in which you're working, you should also know that there are many extraordinary places in this country where you can practice good medicine. And you'll have to go look and you'll have to find them. But they're out there. I was just in Maine last week giving a talk, and I met some of the most extraordinary young physicians who are practicing medicine the way good, ethical physicians like Dr. Kirshner would have wanted young people to practice medicine, to have a career like that. It is possible, but you'll have to go look for it. In closing, I'd like to remind us of why we're all here, what Medicare was established for, and it's about the patient. And this is a quote that I took from Mahatma Gandhi, tweaked a little bit, and here it goes. A patient is the most important person on our premises. He is not dependent on us. We are dependent on him. He is not an interruption in our work. He is the purpose of it. He is not an outsider in our business. He is part of it. We are not doing him a favor by serving him. He is doing us a favor by giving us the opportunity to serve him. Thank you very much for all the good you do for patients who come to this hospital. It's noble work. It's not easy work, but it's work worth doing. Thank you.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It's a mighty hard row that my poor hands have hoed. My poor feet have traveled one hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rode. And your deserts was hot and your mountains was cold. I have worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes. I've slept on the ground in the light of your moon. On the edge of your city you will see us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California, Arizona, we make all your crops. Then it's up north to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, pick the grapes from your vine, to place on your table your light sparkling wine. Pastures aplenty from dry desert ground, from the Grand Coulee Dam where the water runs down. Every state in this union us migrants has been, and we'll work this fight and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, this river and I. All along your green valley I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life, need it be. Cause my pastures are plenty, must always be free. Yes, my pastures are plenty, must always be free.
We have 10 minutes for questions and comments.
Please
come to the microphone, which is over here.
Dr. Kumar.
Mic is not on. I'm in cardiology practice for the last many years. I was very surprised about the hospice. I have a patient who I'm a little bit emotional, so give me the time. I had a patient who I have been taking care for the last many years, and the daughter come to me and she says that I can't take care of her. I want my mother to be put in hospice. So I say, well, your mother is not dying. So she say, well, I want her to be in hospice. But I say, as far as I'm concerned, hospice criteria is that if you have an end-stage cancer and you can't take care of yourself and you're going to die within 6 months or something like that, but your mother is not. So she left. About 2 weeks after that, this patient, I got a form to sign a form to acknowledge that the patient has been already enrolled in hospice. So I had absolutely no role. They bypassed me. And now they wanted my rubber stamp. And I did not sign. In spite of that, she still went in hospice. So the question is, if this is going on, what's the future? I mean, so I think your point is well taken about the hospice. I was surprised myself too, and I told somebody after that incident that this is one of the biggest fraud going on in Medicare now. Because if they can bypass me and enroll a patient in hospice, then you can imagine what can go wrong, what can go happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kumar, for sharing that. I can't imagine what kind of position that you were placed in to ask to put a patient in hospice who was not likely and should not have been placed to need hospice care and should never have been placed in it. I can't imagine what that's like. And I, too, was stunned when I saw what had happened to something that started out as a mission and became something else. And the reason I wrote this book is so people can understand what's really going on. And if this is what's happening in something as important as hospice care, there's a saying in India that you might know that if you have a big pot of rice, all you have to do is take one grain to see if the whole pot is cooked. And so if this is what's happening to the 1% of Medicare, what's happening to the rest of it? Thank you for sharing that. And I believe what we need is more of the public to be aware so we can have a countervailing influence and set up a checks and balances system. But people don't know. But we have to start telling them.
I can never imagine that they can enroll a patient without my permission.
Yes.
I can never. And I don't know who made it.
Yes.
And the person who has never seen the patient, the doctor, he made it.
The person who's never seen the patient made the decision.
And I've been taking care of the patient for 20 years.
And you've been taking care of the patient for 20 years. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you for an excellent talk. Just going to make two comments. One, I'm an oncologist in practice for 20-plus years, more than that. My experience, at least, has not been the type that you had mentioned. But yes, and any time you make anything for profit, things will change and the priorities will change. Tell me what your thoughts on the T.R. Reid's, Book of Healing of America. It's very similar along the lines of yours, where he talks about the fact that he goes to six different countries or seven different countries and looks at different models and comes back with the fact that you cannot have a healthcare entity, or at least the insurance companies, who are for profit. Once you hitch your wagon to the Wall Street, in some form or the other, you're sold your soul.
Well, I think a main point of writing Medicare Meltdown is to show how the influence of our capitalist system has entered such profound private decisions between doctors and patients has affected how physicians practice medicine. And we need to be aware of it and say, what do we do? And the only thing I can come up, because you're right, the system will keep doing what it's doing because that's what it's supposed to do. That's its mandate to its shareholders. And the only checks and balances I can see is setting some limits on how much we can spend. And then within that, we as a society have to figure out how do we have best use of those resources, reduce overuse, improve prevention, keep people healthy, to use it for the right reasons. So I agree with you with that underlying trajectory that's causing great challenges in our healthcare system.
What do you think of the United Kingdom's NICE Institute, National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which raises different issues altogether?
I think we do need to have a conversation about whether we pay for things that work or don't work. The public expects it. Why are we paying for things that are not effective? I talk to physicians who serve on FDA committees, and the FDA is approving drugs that are actually less effective, have worse outcomes, more risks, than drugs that are perfectly fine and already on the market. Why is that? It happens because we have to keep doing the innovation thing. You have to keep the business churning. You have to keep producing it so you can say to your shareholders, this is what's in the pipeline, new drugs. But are they any better? So I think NICE is right in that respect. And what happens, the only side that the public hears is, oh my God, this is rationing, this is government interference. And we don't have a sufficient countervailing influence to say, this is actually good medicine. This is good for you. So I think we should absolutely do it. And we had that with comparative effectiveness research. And the industry, you know, behind the scenes screamed that this was government getting involved in medicine. Well, we should have people who know good science determine whether patients should be getting this treatment or that treatment. That's good medicine. We should be doing it. Yes, sir.
Hi. My name is Bruce Fisher, and I have a look at retired and primarily teaching. There was an article in the JAMA a few years ago called The Perfect Storm of Overutilization, which had several concrete suggestions about what might need to be done. Among, if you will, the villains that they identified were the pharmaceutical industry. And an important one was how we teach medicine. And with the mass rate of thoroughness, we teach overutilization. Yeah. I think we, as people who are responsible for the next generation of physicians, must keep in mind that there's a limit to when thoroughness is good. There's more than that. Tort reform is an important part of it, too. Mm-hmm. All of these things are things which cannot be accomplished overnight, but I think have to be addressed by people like you and the government as well.
I agree about the storm of overutilization, but I've come to the conclusion that we will only get serious about it if we set some limits and we have to make choices. Otherwise, I think we'll keep doing what we're doing. And thank you for trying to educate the next generation on good care, what you need, and helping people get what they need, not what they don't. Yes, sir.
Arvind M. Patel. I'm a urologist, and I frequent this hall every Tuesday morning, and nice to hear you again.
Thank you.
It seems that solution is already at hand, but in the construct of give me a place to stand and a big enough a stick, I'll move the world, is what we don't have. If we need to get some sort of empowerment in this regard to implement some of the things you already identified, but the message doesn't reach in its entirety. That's the thing. If a solution has A, B, C, up to Z, if some of the things are omitted, the solution will not work. Empower the patient to take care of this thing right from the start is what we must be thinking.
I agree that progress is very, very, very slow. We've started over-treatment, a discussion in this country about that. Choosing Wisely came on board to move that very quickly. But I think the only way we're going to take it seriously is if we have limits on how much we can spend so we can make decisions about what works and what doesn't, what's best for the patient, what's not. And the only way to do that is to let the public know about where we're headed. And that's why I included those graphs in the Medicare Meltdown book, that if we keep doing what we're doing, we'll be eating grass and picking berries because there won't be money to do anything else. I grew up in suburban New York, and the grammar school I went to closed in part because of budget cutbacks. Why? Because their health care spending for their employees in this 30,000 population town keep going up. So they closed the school last year, two schools in the school district. This year they're laying off 15 teachers. Why? Because their health care expenses went up 27% in 1 year. So I think the public's getting the message about price transparency, but we need an organizing principle around it. I think that's part of it. And then the next step is setting some limits on how we can spend, how much we can spend as a society. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gibson, for this talk. My name is Eli Kirshner. I'm Jack's son.
Thank you.
And I'm a medical oncologist. What I wanted to talk about was I enjoyed how you explained how Medicare is breaking the bank. But what you didn't really talk about is the whole medical system in this country and how the myth is that we provide the best medical care in the world, which I think is one of the biggest myths that we hear coming out of Washington. We can provide the best medical care for individuals, but as a system, it really is failing. But one of the pieces of information that I think is very interesting is that the health care for people over the age of 65 is better in this country than most other countries in the world, and that is because of the system of Medicare, which is essentially a universal health care system. And the one thing you didn't talk about was the problems with private health care. And it seems to me that that's as big a piece of the puzzle as Medicare and the failings in Medicare. Do you have any comments on where we should go with Medicare in the future, and should it be expanded?
Well, you know, the reality is we're spending enough money on health care in the United States to cover everybody and to provide really good care and to send a rebate check to every citizen in this country. We'd have better outcomes, lower cost, and better health. We can do that tomorrow. And we have to, we have abuse of these wonderful systems, and so we have to correct the misallocation of resources. So what you're talking about is population health for everybody. Keep it simple. You and I talked before this got started. Let's keep it simple. And you're absolutely right. Let's not make it so complex. I went online to see what it's like to choose among 30 competing health insurance plans for people on Medicare in my community. I couldn't figure it out. We've made it so complex in the name of choice. I think we've been sold an illusion of choice. What we need is simple. All of this is so basic. As you as physicians know, the patient at the bedside, let's take good care of them, and let's not lose sight of that. And it's going to be us patients and the public who will have to be that checks and balances on the system that we've sort of been asleep at the switch for 20, 30 years. We've trusted that the system would do the right thing, but it's gotten out of control, and it's time for us to take back our health care. Thank you for your question. Thank you for the legacy of your father's work. And for us to take back our health care.
And now for something completely different.